KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, we do our second of what seems to be a three-part series on KZSU focusing on secrecy with Micha Sifri, author of the book WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency. Last week in our discussion with Archon Fung, we spent some time talking about WikiLeaks and more broadly what we mean by open government and open society. In Micha's very readable and informative book, he focuses on WikiLeaks, but also more broadly on the state of technology in particular in efforts to open up government and to make government information more accessible. And this is a topic of particular importance. Growing import as governments and indeed corporations to a lesser extent are embracing this technology for purposes of sharing more information with the public. The inherent tension inside government, of course, is that while we have legal defaults that point towards transparency, human nature and institutional action pushes against that. And technology offers the opportunity, perhaps, for us to get more information, not only made accessible, but also disseminated in ways that allows for the data and information to be more useful to the public. WikiLeaks, of course, has brought this issue to the forefront most recently and certainly primarily based upon the diplomatic cables. But Micha, in his book, talks about some of the antecedents there, including the now infamous video that was leaked by WikiLeaks a few years ago, showing what appeared to be execution-style helicopter attack on a number of individuals in Iraq. And there have been countless other leaks, most of which did not have that kind of fanfare surrounding them. So part of our discussion today is going to be about WikiLeaks and also Micha's interactions with Julian Assange, who until recently, fairly recently, the last year or two, was someone that you could actually speak to. And Micha had the opportunity to deal with Julian Assange with respect to conferences and also professionally. And so we're going to talk a bit about that as well. But mostly we're going to focus on technology and its relationship to open government. Micha being one of the experts in this area, I'm very excited to have him on the show to discuss it. By way of brief background, he's the co-founder and editor of the Personal Democracy Forum, which is a website and annual conference that covers the ways that technology is changing politics, as well as techpresident.com, which I read regularly. It's an award-winning group blog on how the American presidential candidates are using the web. He is a well-published author. He's been an advisor to the Sunlight Foundation, another terrific organization whose blog I also subscribe to. He's consulted the New York State Senate CIO office, Air America, the Campaign for America's Future, the Brennan Center, and the Regional News Network. His publications list is quite long. He's appeared in a variety of media outlets, and I'm very excited to have him on the show today. So Micha is joining us via Skype from his home in Hastings, New York, not too far from where I grew up in Ossining. Micha, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Dave, it's great to be here.
I should also mention that we're recording on June 28th. Micha, let's start off with a question I ask most of my authors. What describe your genesis and your beginnings of interest in open government moving forward to WikiLeaks. How did you become interested in this topic?
Well, I actually have had, I think, my whole career an interest in how we can open up the political system to make it more representative, to make it more responsive and accountable. And so earlier in my career, I was journalist and editor with The Nation magazine and spent some time reporting and writing about the phenomenon of third parties in American politics, who often are agents of course correction in that we have a two-party system that doesn't respond very well to new ideas. And yet third parties, you know, it's a it's not a very good instrument, as Ralph Nader's campaign in 2000, I'm sure, convinced many people. But, you know, people like Ross Perot can claim credit for having injected important issues into the national debate. So sometimes third parties can open up the process. I also spent a number of years working with an organization called Public Campaign, which is focused on the problem of big money in politics and how it skews the political process towards the interests of the wealthy. And you know, the solution that Public Campaign advocates for is public financing of elections, voluntary public financing. This is something that you have, that you can get if you can convince the incumbent office holders to change the law, or if you can go around them through states where you have the initiative. This is a very, very hard reform to win because, on the one hand, incumbents don't particularly like to change the rules of the game that they already succeeded under, especially if the new rules are likely to make their own re-elections more competitive and less assured. And the initiative process itself is become a big money game, as certainly folks in California can attest and elsewhere. So when the internet came along and started you know, transforming whole chunks of society and culture and commerce, and I got interested in it because I thought this, you know, this force, this or this capacity, really, that, you know, the mass distribution of lateral connectivity, you know, the open internet at its best, empowers the edges, and you know, takes power away from the center, and rewards people for operating in more open fashions than in closed fashions. And I thought, in the same way that it's you know, disintermediating and upending many, many incumbents in the commercial arena, that it might also do the same thing in the political arena. And so starting around 2002, 2003, I got interested, like lots of other people, in blogging and in what that might represent for opening up the media system. And then in 2004, in the wake of Howard Dean's presidential campaign, while I was researching and writing a cover story about open source politics for The Nation magazine, I bumped into a guy named Andrew Roche at a conference on politics online. He was in the process of launching the first Personal Democracy Forum conference in New York later that year, and we decided to join forces together. And the, you know, the issue is unresolved. We, you know, 90% of life for lots of people is just about maintaining their position. And so a lot of people, I think, correctly see the internet and connection technologies as, in all likelihood, tools that will be used by people who are already entrenched and powerful to maintain their position. But if you ask me, you know, in the last 5-6 years, you know, has anything changed in how American politics works? The only answer you can give is yes, the internet has changed how it works, and in some cases, it's made it more open, more accountable. And in other cases, it's had some bad effects. I wouldn't say it's all rosy. The speed up of our news cycle is absolutely in part because so many more people are participating on a daily basis. And speed does not necessarily lead to wise decisions. It just leads to, you know, sort of flitting from topic to topic. So the challenge for those of us who think that connection technologies in the hands of more people can lead to smarter government and more accountable government is that we have to develop better tools and practices than the people who would use all of this stuff just to maintain existing, you know, the existing status quo.
Yeah, and that, and you know, that issue, the what Richard Lanham calls the economics of attention, I think is an important one here that gets us into this technological question with regard to transparency, which since you raise it now, I'll jump to. In the book, you identify three ingredients of the we government, which I'll also ask you to define. But they are abundant information, connectivity, and time. Clearly, I'm not going to answer the question I just asked, but clearly, abundant information ties in there, but also connectivity and time. So perhaps you could talk a bit about those three ingredients in the context of this question of the economics of attention and what we mean by we government.
Right. So, you know, when I wrote WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency, the reason why I decided to do the book was I thought that WikiLeaks was giving. That really this was a teachable moment, and that not just because of the fight between the government and Julian Assange, et cetera, but because WikiLeaks represents a dot on the trend line that we've been living through, and that this was a chance to talk about the larger trend and explain to, you know, people who maybe aren't as clear on what's going on, you know, to get some sense of, you know, what's the bigger picture. We are moving from an age where our public life was shaped by expensive top-down communications tools like television and radio and newspapers to much more open, cheap, and easy to access tools. And the big shift is from a situation where space was scarce to a situation where space is abundant. If you think about TV or radio or newspapers, they all have a limited news hole, right? The evening news is 22 minutes long. No wonder politicians have been forced to speak in sound bites, because the news producers for television are going to edit them down. And there's actually a famous study about the shrinking soundbite, how it used to be 22 seconds, you know, back in the late 1960s, and now it's, you know, shrunk down to about 8 seconds. Mm-hmm. So if you can't make your point in 8 seconds, you're not good for TV. The internet upends that. Because there are, you know, essentially no limits to space online, the cost of storage being so low and continually dropping. You know, I like to point to the example of Barack Obama's speech on race, which he gave during the height of the 2008 campaign. It's 37 minutes long, and yet it is one of his top two or three most viewed YouTube videos. He's, during the campaign, there were more than 6 million views. Hmm. You know, according to the ordinary rules of politics, you would never do something like that and expect so many people to watch it. But online, there's room for rich content at whatever length needed. And that's what we mean by abundance. Connectivity is the fact that we're no longer stuck going through a handful of gatekeepers to connect to each other, that, you know, networks can scale laterally almost ad infinitum. And so what we're moving from, again, is an age where one person with the ability to reach many people is going to be replaced by networks that are just incredibly densely linked, where even if you knock off a couple of key people in the network still you know, will continue. And, you know, good and bad effects to this, of course. Al-Qaeda is a network in that form. But, you know, so was the movement of activists in Egypt, who were, you know, ultimately toppled the Mubarak government, there was no obvious leader that, you know, the police just had to go arrest, or even a small group of leaders that they had to arrest. So connectivity is another critical element in this new space that we're in. And time, again, is the one challenge. None of us have figured out how to work for more than 24 hours a day. But when you think of all the spare time that people have, that we currently put towards, you know, completely, you might say, pointless or, you know, self-indulgent activities like watching television. You know, here I'm borrowing from Clay Shirky, who has argued that now that connection technologies allow us to start huge volunteer projects like Wikipedia and sustain them in part on the, you know, millions and millions of small contributions of people who maybe make one edit, and yet this gigantic world-scale project moves forward, that we actually have abundant time. It's the time that we currently waste on things like watching American Idol. If you can shift even 0.1% of the amount of time Americans spend just watching TV into collaborative volunteer activities, you can build 200 more Wikipedias. In terms of the amount of human hours it takes to maintain Wikipedia. So that's a huge resource that we have available to focus on what I call we government. And what we mean by we government as opposed to e-government is this move from you know, what you might call the first generation of government use of the web, where which everyone calls e-government, which is where the government does a good job at you know, providing information to the public online. You can go on the IRS website and download a tax form, or in some cases you can upload, you know, like your student financial aid application, you can upload online. I mean, these are basic services that enable you as a consumer of information from the government, or as someone who needs to submit information to the government, a simpler way of doing it than having to put it in the mail or, you know, go down to the, you know, the office. We government is really about we the people working with each other and in some cases with the relevant government actors to create through information that we generate or information that the government collects and shares new kinds of services. So a very simple example of this is, you know, here in New York, we've got a entrepreneur who built an iPhone app that enables people who want to know what subway stop, you know, you're on the subway and you want to know where in the train you want to stand in order to get off, like, right by the exit, you know, at the stop where you're going to. Okay, the app is called Exit Strategy. It's built on public data, right? It's built on the subway map, but it was not built by the government, right? But in order for this to be done, it's a combination of, you know, public contribution from the governmental side as well as from, you know, third-party developer. And so we government is the possibility of us sort of plugging in together using these networking capacities that we have and the spare time that we have to generate better services. My favorite example, which I talk about in the book, is C-Click-Fix, which is a startup based in New Haven that grew out of one guy, Ben Berkowitz, had this itch. There was some graffiti on the building where he lived. He wanted to report it. But he was worried that if all he did was make a phone call to City Hall, you know, that his information would drop into a black hole. And, you know, we all know that, I mean, in many cases, government bureaucracies fail to act on problems because, indeed, they are black holes. So his simple idea was, why don't we put this on a website so that when I make the report, I do it through the website, and a you know, a pin goes on the map showing where and when this complaint about graffiti was made. The information gets sent to the relevant government department, and it's all trackable. It's like having a public trouble ticket. And now everybody, including the relevant government actors, you know, whether they're the elected officials overseeing the bureaucrats or the actual, you know, agency in charge of cleaning graffiti, the neighborhood groups, and the people who live around that spot can all kind of keep track of whether this problem is getting resolved. Mm-hmm. You can add comments. You can see the responsiveness rate of a city. And now CClickFix, by the way, is in more than 500 cities in the United States and around the world, many of whom pay the company for the service to plug this sort of dashboard, the front end, into a back end that, you know, integrates with city services. So now the city is tapping the eyes and ears of the public in a new way. But because it's transparent, because the information is visible to everybody, there's a new dynamic about we better get this problem addressed, or maybe this actually isn't such a high priority. You can see all the other high priority problems compared to yours. So there is also a feedback loop here that teaches the citizen something about the complexities of running a city. And so to me, you know, a product like CClickFix is an emblematic example of the potential of we government. And we're going to keep chipping away at this until, you know, we figure out how to deal with more complex kinds of issues. I'm sorry that's a phone call coming in, but someone has picked it up.
Fair enough. So we're chatting with Micha Sifri, author of the book WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Micha, with regard to, and I think after the public service announcement that I'll be doing shortly, we'll talk about WikiLeaks in more detail. But I'm curious, having covered transparency and accountability for years, today, June 28, 2011, what do you see as the current overall status of U.S. governmental transparency? And of course, that could take the rest of the hour, but I'll attempt to narrow it by saying, particularly with regard to the to the executive branch and the agencies. What do you see at this point in a few minutes? And we'll get into more detail after the break as the current state of transparency, given the technology that you've just described.
Yeah. So unfortunately, it's a mixed picture. You know, Obama came in promising a much more open and transparent government. And his, you know, in fact, after a early push by people at the White House level, he, you know, I think in many cases they've lost steam or they've backtracked. The good news is that there was a shift in what people felt they could do inside the agencies, right? I mean, I remember speaking to a group of government web managers in early 2008. And, you know, these are the people who actually, you know, manage and run government websites. And they were like chomping at the bit because for 8 years under Bush, you know, the default setting of government was closed. It was classify information if you can think of any reason to classify it. You know, delay your response to a FOIA request. And God, don't use those new social media tools, right? I mean, the lawyers were in charge and they were really, you know, basically saying no to everything. And under Obama, there really has been a kind of push in the places where people are already inclined to start opening up. And so we do see agencies ranging from NASA to the EPA to the Department of Education, the Department of Health and Human Services. They're making some very interesting strides forward with opening up vital public data and getting it online in structured form so that, you know, you're not dealing with downloading 1,000-page PDFs anymore. This is progress. But at the White House level, after, you know, some early gestures towards operating in a new way, I think Obama himself and his communications people are very focused on control. And when it comes to the national security arena, they're basically continuing the policies of their predecessor, if anything, cracking down even harder on leaks and whistleblowers than we saw under Bush. And, you know, it's really a contradiction. Because if you want to tap the intelligence of the public as well as the millions of people who work in the government, you have to, in fact, support and strengthen the rights of whistleblowers, because even if we get lots more public data posted online in a timely form, and frankly, the Sunlight Foundation, which I do a lot of work with, is working hard to redefine the meaning of the word public to be online, right? You shouldn't even accept the idea that some piece of governmental information is effectively fully public if it isn't online, right? You shouldn't have to travel all the way to Washington, D.C. to look it up in this day and age. And, you know, the impetus for these changes was led by a number of individuals that Obama brought with him into the administration. And now we've seen several of them leave, ranging from Beth Novak, who was in charge of their open government work, to Vivek Kundra, who was the first White House CIO, who just recently announced that he's leaving to go to Harvard. And they're not replacing them. They're not putting the same emphasis on openness in government from the very top. And, you know, in this current fight over budget cuts, we have not seen the White House lift a finger to insist on protecting signature initiatives like the data.gov program. If anything, it's now we have Republicans in Congress, some of whom are big advocates for transparency, who are saying that they will try and, you know, protect the funding for those programs. And this, you know, these kinds of cuts are penny wise and pound foolish, because, yeah, you'll save $10 million or $20 million in the short run, but there's billions and billions in government waste, in even just the fact that they can't track the money that they spend that gets exposed when you at least force the agencies to reveal the data that they're sitting on top of. And so if we kill these signature programs or let them shrivel, you know, we'll end up, you know, ruining that day much, much later from now.
And I'll tell you, you know, it is a drop in a bucket. NPR had a story this morning about the printing of dollar coins, presidential dollar coins, that apparently is costing $300 million. You're hard pressed to find a dollar coin in circulation, and we keep minting these by the millions, even though they're not going into circulation. So it is an interesting is a facile word. It really is extremely sad. Problem that we have with regard to data.gov, which I want to pick up after this short break. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue listening to Hearsay Culture as well as the station. So, Mika, let me do one follow up with regard to the current state of things, which of course is to what can should we or can we attribute this change in focus? Do you have any theories on why the administration has and perhaps it's in part because of some belief with regard to national security issues, but as a general matter or more specifically, do you have any theories as to why the administration has reacted or changed course the way it has?
I think that the problem is if anything, it's an issue of presidential attention. I think Obama personally understands why a more open and participatory government is a good thing, but he doesn't rank it very high on his personal list of priorities, and thus, once delegated, then forgotten. I think, you know, so some of this is, you know, politics as it all comes down to personnel. And so his first ethics counsel was a guy named Norman Eisen, who personally was passionate about this stuff. And then he got an appointment to be ambassador to the Czech Republic. And his replacement, Bob Bauer, doesn't really think transparency is that high a value. If anything, he sees he's written lots of critiques of it. You know, there is a piece of this that high officials don't like because it is about their transparency too. You know, they don't. I mean, they put up with it, the fact that they have to file certain kinds of financial disclosure. But, you know, they would prefer not to. They would prefer to operate in the dark. They, you know, they have this new policy, for example, of making public all the White House visitor records, but it really isn't all the records. They exempt lots of meetings from the records. And then they also have instituted, you know, a de facto practice of holding meetings outside of the White House. You know, you go to Caribou Coffee to meet the lobbyists. And that way it doesn't make its way into the so-called official public record. So there's a certain cynical element here that I think at the very top, you're dealing with very political people. And they are not convinced that this moves the president's numbers in any meaningful direction. You see, I think they made many fundamental choices early on, and one of them was, you know, to push through an agenda on some big problems like the economic stimulus and healthcare without sort of first addressing the things that they could do to regain public trust. Had they done more, I think, to really push openness in government so that people could have a sense that, yes, this is my government too, and I'm helping watchdog how it's spending my hard-earned tax dollars, there might be, you know, greater public support for some of these initiatives. The recovery program, recovery.gov, is an example I go into in my book because it really shows how Obama personally thought that this new program, which was to oversee $787 billion in stimulus spending, would actually engage the public at the grassroots level as the eyes and ears of, you know, Washington, D.C., ensuring that, you know, these millions and millions of dollars in local contracts were actually being properly spent. But in fact, the bureaucrats who set up that website did really nothing to use the open web, the social web, to tap public engagement. And so if you go on recovery.gov even today and look at their blog or look at their efforts to, you know, engage the public, they get maybe you know, 5 or 6 comments a month. And this is on a signature initiative that Obama himself talked about as a way to reinvent how government works. So I think there really was a very big failure of implementation because this vision that the president can articulate well when he chooses to, was not handed to people who either believed in it or knew how to do it. Again, not to color things as completely dark, I do want to point to places like, you know, Department of Health and Human Services, where you've got some fantastic people in charge of reinvention initiatives that are built around open data. A guy like Todd Park, who's the CTO of Health and Human Services, is driving a sea change there that is continuing, that is all around how we, both as individuals and as institutions in charge of providing healthcare, manage and share all kinds of health outcome data. And that, I think, could yet be, you know, the single biggest driver for saving money and improving the health of Americans. So it's not like openness and transparency in government is stalled everywhere. But the closer you get to the White House and the closer you get to, you know, things that might threaten message control from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, the less meat there is on the bone of these things and the more PR that we're getting. And that is because I think that you still got the political people in charge and they fear this stuff. They see it as destabilizing. They don't know, you know, which way it'll go. And at the end of the day, their job is to control the president's image and you know, keep his poll numbers up, because that in Washington is, at least for now, the basis of all power. If people think the president is popular, they're more inclined to respond to his requests. If people think that the president is unpopular, they're more inclined to ignore him. You know, the Republican Party is unified in a very cynical way around just trying to make the president into a failure because it will help them. Not good for the country, but it's good for the Republican Party. And the Democratic Party is divided and doesn't have a clear approach on this. Some parts are good, some parts are bad. And the result is a muddle without much leadership. And then you get WikiLeaks.
Right, which is where I was going to go next here, because I think we've talked about the age of transparency a bit. We can drill down on WikiLeaks, and what I want to ask you though, because the WikiLeaks story is in terms of what they did is fairly well known. Does the existence of WikiLeaks and particularly, you know, the cable releases serve as fodder and support for those that are looking to draw down on transparency? In other words, how does WikiLeaks as an entity impact the debate as you see it?
Well, I think that the appearance of WikiLeaks, you know, in the American scene, which started a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, with the release of the helicopter video, and then the, you know, these huge leaks of Iraq and Afghanistan documents, and then the State Department cables. The impact on Washington has been absolutely to generate a lot of fear and a argument for cracking down and closing up. So, you know, for example, we had when Obama first came in, his directive on the first day of office was, you know, for government agencies to get more open. And then, you know, a few weeks after the State Department cables came out, his same Office of Management and Budget sent out a memorandum across all the government agencies instructing them on how to more tightly control information and to monitor all employees, you know, to keep an eye out for anybody who might be unhappy, you know, even recommending psychological testing and visits with social workers to figure out if somebody might be a risk. And furthermore, telling them that, you know, nobody in government should talk to the press unless authorized, right? That's a big shift from open government to closed government.
Right.
And it's all in reaction or overreaction to WikiLeaks. Furthermore, his Justice Department, you know, is continuing a case trying to, you know, if they can, lasso Julian Assange into some connection with Bradley Manning, the person who's alleged to have actually leaked these materials. So, you know, it casts a very dark cloud, and it's intimidating. And I do think that a lot of would-be whistleblowers in government have been intimidated by the treatment of Bradley Manning. I mean, it took direct personal confrontations with Obama, which were embarrassing to him, by activists on behalf of Bradley Manning, to finally get the guy moved from this situation in Quantico, where he was being isolated 24 hours a day, made, you know, to stand stark naked every morning in front of all the other prisoners. I mean, you know, humiliating treatment that was designed to break him, which, you know, I don't think we should be proud of as Americans, that a fellow American citizen was treated this way. Put him on trial and, you know, let him defend himself. Don't just hold him and you know, and try and mentally torture him. So I do think WikiLeaks recast this debate and put a lot more, if you will, juice on the side of people inside government who want to actually tighten their ability to control information and snoop on others. So there's, you know, you hear the phrase cyber war and cybersecurity, and, you know, the FBI is pushing an interagency plan to somehow rewire the internet so that, you know, they'll have a backdoor into everything. Not only is that technically probably impossible to do, but it's, you know, it's foolish and counterproductive and will only, you know, probably empower other people who are more malevolent, who want to use the same backdoor to snoop on you or steal your credit card information or, you know, other things. So I'm, you know, it's worrisome. The flip side is that for some people, it's been a positive wake-up call in that they are finally beginning to understand that in a networked world where millions and millions of people can participate every day in creating and sharing vital information, that they have lost control and that it's time to adapt and stop thinking of, you know, the power of America solely through its ability to dominate by force. And instead, you know, how can we lead because our ideas are better and our practices are better and we live up to our own values? And that is, I think, an unfinished debate. But WikiLeaks, for many people, has, you know, basically been a wake-up call about this is the nature of journalism in the digital age. It's going to be done by unconventional actors. It's going to be done on a transnational platform that you cannot control in the same way that you can lean on the publisher of a newspaper who's got a physical office and headquarters in your country. And so I think that's quite powerful and for the good. But I'm not sanguine about this. I think that, you know, it was shocking back in last December after the cables came out to see tech companies like Amazon and PayPal, you know, cave in completely to just the merest whiff of government pressure. You know, kudos to Google and kudos to Twitter for, you know, basically standing firm. You know, Google kept, you know, indexing WikiLeaks. They didn't stop helping people find, you know, where they could get to WikiLeaks online through search. But look at Amazon kicking them off their cloud servers just because, you know, some staffer from Joe Lieberman's office put a phone call in and asked them, you know, why they were hosting WikiLeaks. You know, and no one in the tech industry, with the few exceptions, spoke out at the time to say, you know, Amazon, you should be ashamed of yourself. Jeff Bezos, what are you doing? Of course. Why? Because many people in the tech sector actually are just about the money. It was December. It was a few weeks before Christmas. You know, the world's largest retailer online wasn't about to show that much backbone in the face of, you know, Bill O'Reilly organizing a boycott. But I was like, oh, now I understand a little bit what the Joe McCarthy years must have been like for my parents' generation. There was that same sense of guilt by association if you, you know, said anything in support of WikiLeaks. You know, I think that's a very dangerous thing. We learned that this new networked public sphere that we're all thrilled to take advantage of and use every day, right, isn't as public as we thought. It is built on corporate platforms that are shaky, where at any given moment, you know, the owners of those platforms can make choices that are, you know, very self-interested and not at all about a strong public sphere. And, you know, you have to wonder. I mean, the New York Times had the backbone to fight the government at the time of the Pentagon Papers, right, when the government tried to stop them from publishing. And you wonder whether today's equivalents, you know, companies that provide the backbone for this new networked public conversation would fight the government in the same way.
We're chatting with Micha Sifri, author of the book WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency on Hearsay Culture on KZSU. Micha, we only have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and so this is what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I ask questions that you can't answer in the time left. But I ask them anyway. But I do attempt to tailor them. And I think I'll ask this question in closing, because I don't think you could even attempt to answer this in a few minutes. In terms of policy changes, as you see them, are there any policy changes that you would suggest to deal particularly with WikiLeaks? And I'm saying that ambiguously, because of course it depends on your view of WikiLeaks. Putting aside, you know, a general statement like there should be more transparency, more specifically based on your experience, we've seen the Obama administration, as you've pointed out, endorse and begin its administration with promise in this area. We've seen it recede. Obviously, we'd like to see it turn around. But in terms of thinking about technology in particular, with regard to transparency, policy changes, legal changes, what would you urge our members of Congress, let's say, to be thinking about in this context?
Well, I think that there has to be two moves simultaneously. The first one is there's no doubt there's some secrets the government really does need to keep, and they should, you know, shrink the circle of people who have access to that information. But I think a very, very limited amount that really does have to be kept secret, and that, you know, we're in an age of overclassification. So my biggest suggestion would be that they should all go out and dust off a copy of a report on government secrecy that Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan did about 15 years ago while he was in the Senate, where they studied extensively how we had reached the point where, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3 million people have security clearance, and the government creates tens of millions of secrets a year. And look at the recommendations of the Moynihan Commission, because we need to move from the default setting of government of being closed to one of being open. And we need to create a culture inside government that values the open source analyst over the person with privileged access to, you know, top secret information. Because again and again, we've seen how the actually closed information systems work more poorly than open ones. The seminal example that Moynihan gives in his report dates all the way back to the Bay of Pigs invasion early in the Kennedy administration, when they took the CIA's advice and you know, sent this ill-fated group of Cuban exiles off to try and overthrow the Castro government. And the whole thing, you know, completely flopped. Moynihan points out that there was a bit of social science research. Somebody had done a survey of Cubans living under Castro, which had discovered that something like 70 or 80% of the population was happy with the revolutionary government, thought the future was going to get better, not worse. And you know, had anyone read that study inside government, inside the White House, they would have known that it was a fool's errand to send these counter-revolutionaries in, that it would fail. You know, popular governments don't get overthrown. Mm-hmm. But Moynihan notes very dryly in his report that this was a unclassified public piece of research, and thus it was ignored. And he says, had it been classified, they might have paid attention to it. And so the problem with overclassification and systems where people at the very top of the information pyramid inside of government have access to even more tightly controlled information than everyone else is they start thinking that they have the best information and that they can disregard everything else. And you and I know that we live in an age where there is vast wisdom now available to be tapped in crowds, and that indeed there are many, many smart people out there with the ability to see things from a different perspective, or perhaps with, you know, unique information that's of high value. But if you create and support these very closed systems of information usage in government, you actually make government stupider. and yet they think they're really smart and you know more than everyone else. This is, you wonder, how do we keep making these terrible mistakes? And some of it is, I think, at its root, closed information systems built on outdated notions of what's valuable. So we need to move towards a much more open source approach to information in and around government. It isn't just the we government model, which is citizens banding together with government to co-create better services. It's also government letting go a little bit of this hyper-control. And you can even see it in the State Department cables, right? I mean, they told us that the fabric of international community was being irreparably harmed, right? Hillary Clinton's words. And, well, has the world system fallen apart since the release of the State Department cables? I mean, for argument's sake, yes, we've had some revolutions in the Middle East that maybe were in part fueled, especially in the case of Tunisia, by you know, stuff that was in those State Department cables. But is that a bad thing or a good thing? I mean, I think most of us would say the future for people in the Middle East is going to probably be better, and they would themselves say that things are getting better now that they've been able to overthrow these corrupt regimes in a few examples. So, you know, I would say open information is a healthier thing, but it is messy and it is disruptive, and we're going to have to learn to live with that.
Mika Sifri, author of the book WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency. Very quickly, Mika, in 20 seconds, where can people learn more about you and your work?
Well, I run a web project called Personal Democracy Forum. So just go to personaldemocracy.com. The WikiLeaks and the Age of Transparency book you can get from my publisher, OrBooks, which is orbooks.com, and you can order it online there, and they'll send it to you directly, or you can also get the ebook there. You can also use that that big publisher based in Seattle that I was criticizing before, if you really must. Though, if you get it from OrBooks, you can also read it on your ebook reader without rewarding Jeff Bezos for making some dumb decisions every now and then. So that's how to find me. I also have a blog at micha.sifri.com that I irregularly update, though the easiest and fastest place to find me in the daily sort of slipstream of things is on Twitter, where I am MLSIF.
Micha, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I greatly appreciate your time, and I certainly invite you back on the show to continue this discussion. Clearly, these issues, as you mentioned, are only growing in import, and I look forward to chatting with you down the road.
Absolutely, David. It was great fun talking with you.
Thank you. I'm excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on the show, including next week, Professor Peter Gallison of Harvard University, discussing his documentary Secrecy, the third in this triumvirate on secrecy issues. Following that, Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of Common as Air. Professor Marcus Boone of York University, discussing In Praise of Copying. Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants. Professor Susan Shirk of the University of California, San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China. Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University, discussing privacy and context. And rounding out this summer quarter on KZSU, Andrew Renz, research associate and a center for the study of the public domain at Duke Law School. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show returning to its original time slot this quarter, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU. You can also stream it live at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can get the show by podcast by going either to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. You can get it by going to CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to the webpage for the show at hearsayculture.com. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.